Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. In talking to you prior to starting the show today, an interesting topic came up. Is it a coup or is it not a coup, Jim?
Well, technically it's a coup, but things are never that simple in the Middle East. The problem is it can be interpreted as an intervention. However, international law or custom as it now stands doesn't recognize an intervention. It's all semantics, and a lot of politics in the world is more semantics than rule of law. The basic problem in Egypt is that the revolution 2 years ago, which led to the elections, which led to Mr. Morsi's government, which led to the army saying, get the hell out, did not work because Egypt doesn't work. And that's something that gets lost in the media coverage of what's going on in Egypt. The problems with Egypt are basically corruption and misrule. Now, corruption, again, this is something people don't really want to jump in and get their hands dirty with, which is a sort of an ironic way to put it. But corruption is up in the world. There's a recent, I think the Transparency International latest study pointed that out. The United States, as most Americans know, is becoming more corrupt. We look at our health system. We look at the way our government, the relationship between, especially between the executive and the Congress is going. There's a lot of corruption going on there. There's no other way to put it. Anybody living in New York State, like I do, knows that this is actually one of the most corrupt states in the country. And New Yorkers are only recently beginning to talk about it that way. It's been that way for a long time, believe me. And the corruption is what really weakens countries, which turns some countries basically into what they call failed states. It's no accident that the lowest, the countries with the greatest degree of corruption are also generally classified as failed states. Somalia, for example. Afghanistan is there. I mean, you read our coverage on Afghanistan, and we're always hammering away at corruption because basically corruption is the basic problem, aside from tribalism. So Egypt had the problem with corruption, and as we pointed out today in Strategy Page, in the Israeli coverage, where the borders are on fire, as it were, one of those borders is Egypt, and the problem there is corruption, and the Egyptian people, like many in the Middle East and in Africa in the last decade, have realized that, we have fallen way behind other countries which used to be poorer than us. Namely, some of the, South Korea is a great example, Taiwan. What is the difference? Well, both those countries have problems with corruption, but as the Transparency International surveys, point out in excruciating detail, is that, it's a matter of degree. Every country is corrupt, but some countries are far more corrupt than others. And you can basically quantify the impact of this, but the fundamental impact is it discourages entrepreneurship. In other words, starting new businesses, it basically hobbles efficient businesses from growing because basically it's who you know, not what you do, that determines who grows and who doesn't. And it basically means more unemployment and more poverty. And more people on the planet, in general, are saying, hey, that's what our problem is. Now, the solution is poo-pooed. Basically, it's economic freedom. In other words, the ability to start and grow businesses. And only in the last, 20 years have many countries, look at South America. 10 years ago, most of those countries down there were dictatorships of one form or another. Now a lot of them are democracies with thriving economies. And it's no accident because a democracy, by definition, means people get together and agree. They compromise. They agree and disagree. They basically make deals. And they don't simply let a bunch of insiders, do whatever the hell they want. In other words, it's settled by vote of the majority, which means honest elections, which a real democracy has. Again, It's a matter of degree. India is the largest democracy on the planet. Their elections, as corrupt as India is, their electoral process is pretty clean by world standards. And that's what keeps them going. I mean, India, think about it. It's got three times the population of Europe and even more ethnic groups. You know, we think of India as a monolith. It is not. You know, it's got more differences, ethnic and linguistic and what have you differences, you know, than Europe, which is, which most Westerners see as that's a polyglot area. It's nothing compared, you know, to India. So if you make the effort, and it takes a lot of effort, as the old saying goes, freedom isn't free and democracy is hard. You know, you basically, you know, reap the benefits. Now, the Egyptians want some of that change, and they're not getting it, because when the overthrow of Mubarak, who was a classic, you know, which was a classic democratic tyranny, in other words, it was technically a democracy, but all the elections were rigged. So basically, it was a dictatorship. When he was overthrown, the people who kept him going, in other words, the corrupt bureaucracy, the businesses, you know, the families, as I like to describe them, there's basically a few dozen families who control most of the economy, and the military, which is extremely corrupt, they were not changed. Indeed, the population that rose up, as it were, took to the streets, they praised the army for not intervening on the side of Mubarak. Now, what was going on there was that the army was looking out for itself. The most of these soldiers in the Egyptian army are conscripts. They are kin to the people in the streets. So the Egyptian generals, given credit, they're not stupid. They may be thieves, you know, and totally corrupt, but they're not stupid. They say, hey, you know, if we try and support Mubarak, who basically is becoming a dysfunctional, you know, tyranny, and we start, you know, shooting it, we're liable to have mutinies, and then we lose everything. So they sided with, you know, whoever, they sided with the rebels, and let's hold elections. Well, they held elections, but the problem there was the only group that was organized to basically run an election that could participate were the parties that basically were belonged to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood's been around for almost a century, and they've basically been outlawed. Long story short, Egypt went from monarchy to military government, basically Sadat, Mubarak, and what had Nasser, in the 1950s. And the Muslim Brotherhood, which protested at first, they were outlawed, but they were allowed to basically form, you know, independent political parties, which, of course, were cheated at the ballot box. But what the Muslim Brotherhood could do that nobody else could do was they could organize in the mosques. In other words, the government would not try and take over the mosques. I mean, they try, they give money and what have you. They occasionally punish a cleric. But basically, you could get away with a lot politically inside the mosque. And that's where the Muslim Brotherhood not only organized, that's where, you know, basically addressed followers, but they also did good works. They practiced what they preached. So when Mubarak was gone and his official party, which always won the elections, was barred from participating, the only people who had a political organization were the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic Conservatives. Now, these guys did not represent what all Egyptians wanted, because basically the Muslim Brotherhood political organization and its allies, other basically religion-based, you know, mosque-based political organizations, many of them more extreme than the Muslim Brotherhood. Because the Muslim Brotherhood, we should point out, in the 1960s and 70s, there was a division in the Muslim Brotherhood. Part said, all right, let's go underground, let's stay in the mosque, let's organize, let's basically prepare for the long haul. And then there was a more extreme group, which started a terrorist campaign in the 1990s, which was put down with great violence and with public approval. Because basically the radicals, and one of those leaders of that group, Sahari, he's now running Al-Qaeda. Many of the organization, the radicals, were crushed, again, with a lot of public participation. You know, a lot of ordinary Egyptians were telling the cops, who are very corrupt and not well-liked, they said, this is where, you know, they're hanging out. And a lot of them fled, and they basically formed the cadre, you know, the founding group of Al-Qaeda and several other organizations, but Al-Qaeda was their biggest accomplishment, which isn't saying a hell of a lot. Egyptians don't forget.
Wow.
They do not like this sort of radicalism, and so that's why you had this second, you know, revolution, because the Morsi government, which got elected, you know, I mean, it was fair and square, but they were the only ones organized to go out and solicit votes and what have you. So it really wasn't fair. They basically had to listen to their extremists, and their extremists were saying, we want ultimately an Islamic state run by Sharia, Islamic law, and most Egyptians don't want a religious dictatorship. And that's where they were headed. Now, they always said, no, we're not going there, because indeed, many people within the Muslim Brotherhood did not want that, because they knew it didn't work. They could look at Iran, they could look at what Afghanistan did in the 90s, they could look at what Sudan is doing right now. It doesn't work. But it was working, and that's why the generals who said, this didn't work out too well for the military in Iran, so let's listen to the people and basically, you know, shut Morsi down, and let's try elections again. So the idea is this next round of elections, 2 years later, will basically have the Democrats, the secularists, whatever you want to call them. I mean, a lot of the people opposing Morsi were Islamic conservatives. They some of them even said, all right, we can have some Islamic law, but basically we want what the West has, which is rule of law, what we call civil society, and the opportunity for the economy to grow, so we're not all constantly on the verge of starvation. That's what's supposed to happen. But what has not happened is that the economic stranglehold the oligarchy still has on the economy is still there. The military is still there. So you can see where this is going. Nowhere.
Right. Austin, coup or not a coup?
Oh, it's definitely a coup. I like Jim's term, which he calls an intervention. But no, it's a coup. But let's put it, it's a coup in a peculiar context. Jim says there are always extraordinary circumstances in the Middle East. Well, Egypt is experiencing a very slow, low-grade civil war. And the military, and this is another way to frame it, it doesn't exactly fit totally into the neat corners of the frame. I think, as Jim said, it's the Middle East. But the military has sided with what we'll call the more liberal Muslims, the secularists, and modernizers. There are also 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 or 12 other groups that fit in with this conglomerate. But the thrust there of this group is liberalization of the economy. Jim spoke about the goal of furthering entrepreneurial experimentation and innovation in order to grow the economy. Well, that's what they would like. Ending corruption. That's going to put them at odds with the military, ultimately. But at this time, so the military is adapting. Jim said that the military had seen what happened to the Shah's imperial army in Iran. They'd seen the reaction of their conscripts. When their conscripts are, we're not going to shoot our cousins and our brothers and sisters and our parents. They know, the military's educated. The higher ranks are well-educated and quite sophisticated. They know what the components of modern economic success require. They do require a liberal economy. They require rule of law. They require education. It requires, among other things, the ability for free flow of information. Now, many of these requirements don't sit well with someone who has in charge of all the air conditioner sales in Cairo, as well as running a mechanized infantry brigade. I'm not saying anybody in particular there, but rice brokerage, selling rice and cotton brokerage, as some of the military has been allegedly involved in aspects of those kinds of transactions. I think the allegations are probably founded, but who knows? The those that kind of openness cuts against their corrupt economic interests. But at the same time, they have no interest in the destruction that comes with a theocratic dictatorship. Now, let's look at Mohamed Morsi for a moment. Jim provided a few sketches of where Mr. Morsi said he would go and didn't go. One of the things that he had promised was that he was not going to ram a Sharia-based constitution down the throats of his political opposition. He, when he was campaigning, when he was after his election, he said he wanted to maintain a united front. Well, United Revolutionary Front, United Front commitment to democracy. If you remember Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was the first president of Iran, just for a short period. He's now been in exile, I think, since 1981 or 82. He's lucky he's alive, because Khomeini would have killed him otherwise. But Bani Sadr wrote an essay, I believe it appeared down in the Christian Science Monitor in late January of 2011. And it was an essay for the people of Tunisia and how to save their revolution. And he went back and very, very coolly analyzed what went wrong. We fragmented, he said. We didn't stay committed to individual rights and a democratic, secular democracy, and the radicals, meaning the Khomeinists, picked us off one by one. And he said, you must maintain a united, a compromise among yourselves, because there is so much change that needs to be addressed, and it's fundamental change. Jim was talking about corruption, rule of law. But this is, do the people stay together on this and say, these are our goals, and we'll fight the radicals, you'll succeed. Well, that didn't happen in Iran. The Egyptian army has decided to fight the radical tendencies that they saw Morsi expressing. Now, I'm not 100% convinced that he actually had a theocratic dictatorship as a goal. I see Mohamed Morsi as being basically an incompetent. I mean, he's a man who understood that one of his goals was he had to turn the economy around, but he had no idea how to do that because entrepreneurial activation was not something on his list. It had not been discussed in the mosques. Getting a Sharia-based constitution, despite what he had said, that was part of the agenda, because for years, as they were allowed to work in the mosques, the line from the Muslim Brotherhood is, Islam is the answer. Islam is the solution. Almost as if a magic incantation, whatever brand of Islam, they weren't quite sure, their brand, this mosque brand, but if we have get it right with God, the economy will get right. Well, that didn't happen. And, of course, what he did was in November of 2012, the secularists broke with him definitely. And then what happened in January of this year, Dan, really hurt his own coalition among the, as Jim noted, there are many political Islamists that do not want a dictatorship. They're completely against it, and they want economic reform. They want Egypt to be the successful great country that they feel it should be, that they believe it should be. But it was at the end of January with the riots going on in Ismailia, Suez, and Port Said. I know we discussed those briefly in the past. There were violent riots. People were several dozen people killed. He declared a state of emergency. Morsi did. Now, state of emergency, rule by decree. Guess what Mubarak did for three decades? Jim will tell you. He ruled under a emergency decree. It was a permanent state of emergency. And Morsi had an emergency to deal with. But under rule by decree, he's basically a quote-unquote temporary dictator. And you can employ the army to go in directly to handle police functions. His members of his own coalition said, wait a minute, are you so tone deaf? Do you know who you sound like? You sound just like Mubarak. And that will send a shudder through his own, Morsi's own Islamist coalition. He was supposed to be for a month. I think it was 11 or 12 days later. He says, oops, sorry, didn't need to do it. There are ways he could have handled the situation with reinforced police and the like, but he didn't do it. He went with another one of these decisions that gave him power, that put him at the center, and therefore, whether he was or not, he was behaving as a proto-dictator. And that's when the Civil War, in my view, really began, when he did back down. But he'd sent a couple of army units into the cities. The army didn't want to go, but the army did when they were ordered. And I wonder over time, this is a speculation on my part, if we won't see the military at that point saying, you know, you were about to use us to put down, it looked like we were putting down a revolution. Now, I know there were riots, but there was a component of struggle between more Islamists and more secular in a couple of those cities. I think they were being expressed, as I recall, by two soccer clubs in one place. One soccer club was more secular, and the other was a pro-Muslim Muslim Brotherhood. And there the army makes a decision somewhere in this second spring of 2013 that if Morsi does not back down on some of his programs, if he doesn't moderate and change, we may need to act. And you certainly see the opposition around Mohammed al-Baradei and the like begin to demand that Morsi resign because you have not lived up to what you said you would do. We need a competent figure running Egypt who will address the panoply of troubles that we have. So coup, Dan, yes. Coup to avert a civil war or coup as part of a slow civil war, I think time will tell, but that's another way to look at it.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is what is going to happen to Morsi over the long run, Jim? And that's the topic we'll end with you and Austin commenting on that.
Well, right now he's under arrest, and I don't think any decision has been made, because if they wanted him dead, he would have died resisting arrest, as it were. I think the army leadership realizes that they have to play this as straight as they can. Again, they want to hang on to what they have. They, in effect, want to broker a more efficient government that will give them an amnesty. That will say, for example, the Chinese military had a similar situation where the government ordered them to get out of business because they had always been corrupt. Well, they hadn't been corrupt for a period early, right after the communists took over, but the corruption came back as it always has in China. They had become extremely corrupt. And in the 1990s, the party said, sell all your holdings and go back to just being professional soldiers. Well, they did sort of sell all their holdings. A lot of generals got very rich. And they're still corrupt. They just found new ways to do it. The Egyptian military basically wants to, you know, get away with it. And to do this, they basically want to make as few mistakes as possible. Killing an elected president is not a good thing under any circumstances. Even Mubarak was not executed out of hand. You know, he's basically using his money, the billions he stole, you know, to basically outlawyer the government, which so far is succeeding. So Morsi will probably survive. He'll probably end up in the West, maybe even the United States, who knows. He'll writing his memoirs and continuing to be a pain in the ass and a fellow traveler with, you know, Islamic radicals worldwide.
Austin?
I agree with everything Jim said. I think Morsi may actually turn it into a money-making proposition for himself, be a cause celeb. I don't mean to sound cynical about it, but that would be the wisest choice for him. Another option, of course, is to insist on fighting it, saying, you know, I am the legitimate president, and they're many voices around the many places around the world, governments that will support him, and he could insist on that, insist on having a trial, a show trial, and the like, and it would the slow civil war would continue. You would see the Al-Qaeda element activated. I mean, Al-Qaeda is always activated, but here they would have a quote-unquote a legitimate nationalist cause in Egypt as a recruiting tool. Of course, they are never know how to limit themselves, and the tragedies that that they would perpetrate would come back and boomerang on them politically. Nevertheless, that's a choice there, and if somebody's talking to Mr. Morsi right now and said, well, here's the hard line, and let's say you stay alive, and we protect you and the like, do you want to put Egypt through that kind of bloody convulsion? He could make that choice, but I think the international celebrity is the wiser choice for him.
Yeah, my bet is that he'll be lecturing at Berkeley next year, but that's just my take on it. All right,
that's
thank
just
you,
the
gentlemen.
View from Utah.
Right, that's the view from Utah. Well, we'll wrap it up there, and I'm sure we'll be talking about Egypt in the future again. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We'll see you
next time. Bye-bye.